This is Two Dope Boys and a podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
And Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. There's beef in the streets. I feel very pumped up.
Beef in the streets. Sheether was one of the more... That was just that... I don't think it's the best rap diss track ever made,
no,
obviously.
Not at all.
Not even remotely, but the level of just like that contempt level was almost uncomfortable in a way that I have never actually felt comfortable listening to any other diss track.
But I feel good
spent
about
a lot of time
generally
on the surgery.
That there's beef in the air.
A lot of time on the surgery. I think like whenever as soon as told me someone was like, "Hey, did you hear that new Remy Ma, the Sheether?" And I was like, I'm sure she talked about her ass, right? And they were like, yeah, but you should still listen to it. And I listened to it and I was like, it's one thing when you go with what you expect. Like, of course, you're going to make a shot at that surgery. But then when you do it, like she took it past the point of like cliche, past the point of beating a dead horse, just to another level of like, wow, you really broke down every single angle of that.
Really, I thought it was like our dad.
Come in. We got crew. She can't wait. She got to talk about Sheether.
You're going to talk about Remy, then I'm ready to go.
All right. Introduce yourself to everybody again, to the Dope Boys-iverse, and then get to Remy.
Biz Gormley. Happy to be here. It's been a while. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. Sheether. Thoughts?
I know you're a big Thank Mickey you, fan. Remy, for coming back and actually making a rap track. No, I heard it over the weekend. I thoroughly appreciated it. I thought the surgery commentary was heavy on the front end, but actually was part of the kind of burlesque, that's a funny trip up, kind of Baroque ornamentation that she just kept bringing it back,
yes.
kept bringing it back. Yes. It was like to just remind us where we're at, what's really going on here. It was kind of foundational. It was decorative, but it was fitting around some really, really meaty attack. So it was not
like
just like
so many on. I love the amount of, like you said, foundational, meaty.
Yeah.
Front
All
ends,
these nice words when describing
back
ass.
End. Yeah. That was interesting. No, I mean, I'm not, I always have to apologize to my Trinidadians every time I say this, because I know at least in like Trinidad itself, there's a lot of love for Nikki from my experience, but I don't care.
When I heard Nikki's
I've never
early
really,
stuff,
I've never
I was
really
like,
been
oh,
into Nikki.
Okay. But as soon as Nikki hit the US market, I was like, I don't get it.
Like, I don't hate her, but I don't care. And then when she went and did that shit in Angola, that hit my woke zone, which is hard to hit because I'm a pretty cynical dude in a lot of ways. But when you go and you perform for some, like, you know, kleptocrat family and people call you out on it and your response is all like, you know, like you're going to have your like when we were kings moment. It's just like, all right, whatever. Go get another surgery.
I can't believe you just used when we were kings with Nicki Minaj.
That's how she tried to frame it. Like,
yeah,
I'm going
to
go see my
like
ancestors. I'm going to do. And it's just like, why don't you just say you're going to take the check?
Yeah.
Like, just stop. Just
I've never,
spare
like,
me.
I've never been a Nicki Minaj fan. Like, she's super cornball to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
But it's, that's part
she's
of
She's living off of, like, one verse on Monster. Like, people want to give that, like, she's like AZ. Like, you just.
No, like, dude, AZ,
I mean, she ain't as bad as AZ. That's
Nicki
a bad.
Minaj to
but
AZ.
I'm saying, like, one verse elevated her to, like, this level where people are like, oh, she's one of the great lyricists. And of all the great, like, if you want to even make it, like, a gender thing, of all the great women rappers that we've had.
Female.
Yeah, see, I was trying
female
to avoid
rappers.
Using the word female.
Because you were going to make it a gender thing. And you're
yeah, we got
to
a whole
them.
Dressing down for using female.
My favorite lady
As
rappers.
As a term for gender?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not.
Yeah.
Right. We're effing up here. We're way off time here. We got to get
to
the brand F up.
We are.
We got to get
but
to the brand
anyway,
F up.
Anyway, she ain't one of the top female
She's
rappers.
Not one of the top, but AZ is a great rapper. Now we got to get to the brand F up of the week. What do we have, Phil? And do present it in your urban way.
I will do my best Thank to you. Be as urban
yeah,
as I can.
Urban.
I'm as I describe this, but London Nightclub. Let me get the name of this club for y'all. Because anyway, let me give y'all, while I'm looking for the name of the club, don't go to spots in Mayfair in central London. If you're going to London, go out in the outskirts where real folks is at, where you're going to get some grime, you're going to get the real flavor. You definitely don't want to mess with spots in the middle of London where, unfortunately, Mark Ingram, who's a New Orleans Saints running back, and several of his teammates went to a club called Cirque Le Soir, and they were turned away and denied entry for being too urban. And I can't believe we're still using, somehow the word urban has become synonymous with black, which in this club means they don't really want you in there. So they asked these brothers to leave the spot. And, you know, it's just generally kind of whack like that we're still doing this in modern day times. But I guess, you know, we did just have Brexit. So anything's on the table right now.
Should just have everything.
Yeah.
It said Cirque Le Soir said they were too dark and overweight. Which I think, on top of the urban thing, those are the quotes that they're delivering. Like, I can't. I don't even know how to freaking start with that.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Just add for good measure. It's not just that they were urban; they were also overweight.
And then they had a tweet.
Absolutely preposterous.
They tweeted a few days later talking about it's lit with fire emojis and keeping it 100. And people are like, yo, how are you using words like this when you just said, like,
take the words, pass on the black.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. Yes, we'll be taking the emojis and passing on the fat black men. Thank you very much. It's like, these are the types of stories that are just like, you know, I think sometimes the F up is just the reminder of, you know, and I think also the global reminder in this instance. And then if we were going to just add like any lesson to it, it would be, I mean, London has put in so much work going back, you know, actually tackily enough, but reality is like the late 90s with Tony Blair and Cool Britannia and all of this to really be this, you know, global beacon in so many ways. And that has also created its own incredible universe of problems and mass inequality and over-reliance on finance and everything else. But it's also created, I mean, I know I've been there briefly. I know that Matt studied there. I know, Phil, obviously you've done a lot in London, and there's truth to it. And you just can't be part of benefiting from that world and, you know, and then still, you know, behave like this as a club. It's completely antithetical to everything you're trying to ride off of. But, you know, this is what happens. This is what late adapters do. They suck to begin with. They don't get it. And there you go.
And, you know, don't get it twisted. They do the same shit.
Yes.
Here in New York. Any major city, whether it's more so like New York, New York got that bullshit club shit on lock. But, you know, we can talk about to Steve Lewis about this. He's going to be with us in a couple of weeks. And, you know, there is a race element to nightlife.
Right.
You know,
of course.
Clips had a song about
the black race bouncers. Element to life.
Yeah. It's usually the black bouncers keeping brothers out of spots. Right. You know, so this is not really surprising, though, in the age of social media where these stories would have happened kind of one off. Now, obviously, you got a NFL player who can kind of put you on blast.
Yeah, that's the real thing that stands out to me. People won't let it go. This isn't going to be a quickly forgotten thing for this club.
Yeah, and they're going to be in trouble. And that is the real F up. We got to
get... Fuck you, Cirque Le Soir.
Yeah.
Cirque Le Soir.
I refuse to figure out how to pronounce that name.
Yeah.
All right, now we got to get to what's up. So now we got to get to what's up. And we were just saying that what's the worst? Uber is the worst. And Uber has been in the news. We talked about Uber a couple of weeks ago with regards to its position with the Trump administration, its role during the acts of protests and resistance that took place across the country with regards to the Muslim ban several weeks ago. And now there's some new things about Uber that are recycling in the news. So they are kind of what's up, but they're also what's been the case for a very long time about this company. And we'll explain that in a moment. But before we do, we have a little bit of sound to play you. This is a captured video of Uber CEO Travis Kalanick talking with a Uber driver. I would imagine he's a former Uber driver.
Well,
former regular cab driver who switched to Uber. What was his name again? I'm sorry, Matt.
Fozzie Camel.
And Fozzie Camel has problems with basically Uber changes the terms of service for their employees regularly. So when you think about it, this is significant because a lot of people who go into Uber to be drivers, as an example, invest in buying their own cars. They lay a lot of money out up front based on certain calculations and certain returns, which Uber regularly shifts around and plays with. And of course, it's not really a surprise because Uber's ultimate plan obviously involves completely getting rid of all drivers in the long term. It's not terribly surprising that they'd screw them in the short term. But this driver confronts Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, and he responds as well as you'd expect him to.
Thank you. You have a good one. Thank you.
Good to see you, man.
Thank you. Good to see you, too. I don't know if you remember me, but it's fine.
The
new people, the old people, 2010.
Yeah. Super legit.
Yes, yeah, super legit, but we got 15
miles. So we are reducing the number of black cars on the system over the next 6 months.
Yeah, it's good.
I mean, you probably saw some emails.
I saw the email starts in May. It's all about the rating. But you're raising the standards and you're dropping the prices.
We're not dropping the price on black.
But in general, the whole price.
Yeah, we have competitors. Otherwise, we've got a business.
Competitors, man. You had the business model in your hands. You could have the prices you want, but you choose to buy everybody a ride.
No. You're misunderstanding. We started high-end. We didn't go low-end because we wanted to. We went low-end because we had to, because we'd be out of time.
What, and this? It's a piece of cake right there.
No, it seems like a piece of cake because I've beaten them. But if I didn't do the things I did, we would have been beaten, I promise.
Higher? We could go higher and more expensive. You get the
So here's the thing. We could do Lux in San Francisco. So I have guys working on Lux, which will be 50 to 75% more expensive than
but
Black.
But people are not trusting you anymore. Do you think people will buy cars anymore? Unless they buy them through the invoice. Otherwise, nobody want to buy a car. I lost $97,000 because of you. I bankrupt because of you.
Look.
Yes. You know, you keep changing every day.
What have I changed about Black?
Huh?
What have
you
I changed?
You changed the whole business.
What?
You dropped the prices.
On Black?
Yes, you did.
Bullshit.
We started with
$20. Bullshit.
We started with $20.
You know what?
How much is the mile now? $2.75?
You know what?
What?
Some people don't like to take responsibility for their
own
shit.
I take responsibility.
They blame everything
but
in their life on somebody
else. But why
are
you sending an email for Town Car?
Good luck.
Good luck to you too, but I know you don't gonna go far.
This is great because he basically got like an old school dressing down from a cabbie, which is great. And just to kind of give you some context here, and then we'll pivot to the other thing that Uber is in the news for. This driver, basically he told Kalanick that he had lost about $100,000because of you, and that when he started with the Uber Black car, Uber prices, they started at $20 a mile. And now it's at $2.75, apparently, he said. So those numbers have gone down significantly. And then what I love about it is that Kalanick does like the classic Silicon Valley kind of move, which is that first he like pontificates about vague technological breakthroughs that will solve the problem for both of them. And then when he's pressed on that, he finally says, you're not going to take responsibility for your own problems. And a lot of people don't. And that's bullshit. Which makes total sense. So there's the sort of inequality and employee piece. And now we have a post from a woman named Susan J. Fowler who wrote about her experience of sexual harassment at Uber. And this is just a really bizarre story. And I'll quote from it briefly and then we'll open it up. She worked in, I believe, the engineering division. After a couple of weeks of training, I chose to join a team that worked in my area of expertise, and this is where things started getting weird. On my first official day of rotating in the team, my new manager sent me a string of messages over company chat. He was in an open relationship, he said, and his girlfriend was having an easy time finding partners, but he wasn't. Sorry. He was trying to stay out of trouble at work, he said, but he couldn't help getting in trouble because he was looking for a woman to have sex with. It was clear he was trying to have sex with me, and it was so clearly out of line that I immediately took it to screenshots and took the messages to HR. Moving forward, she went to HR, and basically HR told her that they would give the guy a stern talking to, but he was a good performer, and he was not going to get any sort of actual repercussions. And she should choose to leave his team because it was almost certain that she would get bad reviews. So obviously this fits into a much larger pattern with Uber. It's the sort of, you know, there's been a lot of questions around that company and sexual harassment issues. So these things both happened this week. More bad news for Uber, more kind of failures on all of the types of issues we talk about. And I just want to open it up.
I just first want to say that I mean, nothing about this is funny to me. I think that there's a lot of layers to look at Uber and criticize it. Uber's been in the, in my personal feminist shit list for a long time, based on the fact that they haven't at any point come out in support of their riders in a way that has been protective of them. Especially when they had, there was reports like, you know, 5 years ago, oh, we only have 170 cases of rape in our car. It's like people being charged
they
with rape.
They said only 170?
Yeah.
As if that was like an exculpatory number?
Yeah. And okay. I also think that I have never worked in a tech company as a woman, but I don't know a woman who has that hasn't had a rough time based on her gender. So there's like all these layers to how in some ways predictable this is for this company, for this industry. And also like, the surprise that people are feeling is actually what I'm finding most shocking. You know, the idea that Uber was ever on anybody's side, whether it was the drivers, whether it was the employees, whether it was the staff coming in on a low level, whether it was anyone but them and the top level and the investors. Like, those are the only, you could fit the number of people that Uber really seemed to care about in a very small room. So the idea that this is like a any sort of pivot from where they've been standing, any sort of adjustment from where they've been playing, and anything but predictable is, to me, it's not true, but it's also interesting that now all of a sudden they're getting all this traction. Like, over 200,000 people deleted and left the company after
hashtag
that.
Delete Uber.
Yeah, yes. And so there's real repercussions happening for them on a financial level.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. That was the most outrageous thing to me. When I was sent the letter, and we have a listener who actually sent me the letter first before it blew up. He sent it to both of us, actually. Right. And I read it. I remember the evening I read it. I was like,
smart, dope people.
This is a terrible story for like Susan, but her yeah. Susan J. Fowler, the engineer who wrote this letter. But I think this is something that many women who work in these industries could probably relate to on sure. one level or right. another. The individual circumstances might be different, but this idea of HR not taking any responsibility for the employees' well-being or safety, and that this actually being encouraged, you know, this sort of behavior, as you read through this letter, is encouraged, and you see that Uber has no real concern for the culture of the people within the organization, and they have no respect for anyone outside
encouraged
the organization.
Because it's not right. responded to.
It's not responded to, and in a way,
it's not. Okay, yeah, I just want to clarify.
I mean, I would
people.
Say, In a certain way, it is kind of encouraged. Like, this sort of bully attitude, this sort of asshole dick attitude that pervades, to me, it started probably like 50 years ago in like Hollywood casting rooms, like the casting couch that everyone made fun of for years. It kind of probably hit Wall Street and hedge fund world. And then I've always said that when Wall Street and Wall Street / hedge funds was sort of seen as the old guard of asshole behavior. Mm-hmm. And tech branded itself in this sort of, oh, we're different. We care about making the world better and we're utopian and we're going to do all these things so differently. And I always said, like, yo, it's the same people.
Yeah, I think that you that's know? Actually in some ways the one of the really crucial points is that Silicon Valley has gotten a really, you know, until the last couple of years, it's shifted up a little bit, but it got a free ride for a long time. And also it's, you know, it's fascinating to me. I mean, I think even the hedge fund and finance world got at least certainly far too much of a free ride for a long time until the crisis of 2008, right? I mean, there was still even a lot of kind of cultural currency around that. Not only is Silicon Valley in some ways the old guard kind of reconstituted, but it's actually also in some ways a new guard, which in certain areas embraces a public philosophy and way of going about things and conception of business, which is maybe even more destructive and dangerous. I mean, there's a lot of libertarian fantasies in Silicon Valley. There's, you know, a guy like Peter Thiel, who I hope he doesn't try to sue this podcast out of existence or anything else that I do, because I do make fun of him a lot. But, you know, you look at someone like this who fuses this kind of bizarre, fanatic market ideology, even though the goal is actually to create monopolies, and someone who has, you know, himself said in public forums in the past, at least as a college student, that, you know, he wouldn't, I think, you know, woman voting isn't a great idea, as an example. And this is someone, and of course, he's a big supporter of Donald Trump. We all know what that means. And Kalanick's connected with Donald Trump. So not only are, you know, is this industry not benign or inherently progressive or forward thinking, it actually in some ways has some even more extreme toxic ideological leanings. And it shows up in everything from the abuse of drivers to sexism inside the company to also, I think, you know, and we talk about this a lot, not even the cultures of what's produced and what they lead to. They're not thought, you know, the notion that we're heading to this world where people aren't going to drive anymore and it puts a couple million more people out of work is clearly not something that companies like Uber are thinking about from any type of societal or strategic perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't tend to trust people who speak on behalf of others as knowing what others are thinking or feeling, which is to say that when you have a track record of many, many years as a company either being charged with, you know, being when Uber has faced the threats from customers to leave because they felt unsafe or actually been sued for creating environments that they were unsafe in the cars and not even stepping up for the safety of the people paying, forget even the drivers. And then a bunch of white guys march out to say, like, oh yeah, like, you know, this gentleman who's been a cab driver for many, many years, like, I'm going to speak for him in this situation. Or these women that have all these experiences, they're wrong. None of what they're saying is true. I mean, it resonates. You talked about the financial industry with the idea that, like, women come to interview at financial companies so that they can sue them for sexual harassment. Like, these false narratives of the predatory nature of people who come to work or drive around in Uber cars is almost entertaining compared to the reality of the leadership's
and these are cultural issues, you know, right. this guy Travis what's his last name?
Kalanick.
Travis Kalanick.
And of course his name is Travis.
Has been on the record for having just a predatory laissez-faire attitude to running this business, and all too often that's celebrated. Like, we've emboldened this idea of the so-called singular genius who is brash and rude and kind of a dick, and that's what makes him, I'm using him on purpose because we never think of these traits as being rewarded if you're a woman or a person of color, but if you're a white guy and you're just an asshole, that means that you must know something that we all don't know, and that's elevated.
It's not always true. I mean, sometimes it is.
Sometimes it is, but very rarely, like 0.001% is that true.
I enjoy being the 0.001.
I'll give it to you only.
All right.
But we gotta confront these as cultural issues,
yes.
And the company is not gone. And there's a letter by two early investors, the Kapoors, who are well known. Husband and wife, well known in those circles, VC circles, and they invested early on in Uber. And they go through this letter that reads like, well, we were waiting for them to change when this happened. We were waiting for them to change when this happened. And it's kind of a call to action. Like, investors and people who have resources should not be giving this these people this much rope.
And they also need to realize that it's just, you know, this is the positive aspect of technology and the positive aspect of the brand F up. I mean, you know, one of many, I guess, is that, you know, this stuff is reported and documented in real time, and the turnaround time for being an asshole is a lot faster now. So even like the kind of traditional glorification, like, you know, Steve Jobs is actually like the, you know, obviously the one example that people bring up.
He's the patron saint.
He's the patron saint. And he also might, in some ways, maybe he's the exception. I'm sure I'd be willing to accept without riding him the way a lot of people like to. I'm not really that interested in Steve Jobs. I'm sure he was a bit more talented and interesting than your average, you know, than Travis Kalanick, right? Like, that's not that hard to pull off. But I think that, you know, the type of abuse that he engaged in, going down actually in more substantively along with Google and some other companies with a wage suppression, which they did in sort of forming a cartel together. That was a major legal case several years ago. If he was doing the types of kind of things and abuse that he was doing now in real time with our social media culture, it might be something that emerged and was sanctioned now and actually was a different type of problem for the company than something that's just reported in an article years later, like, oh, there was this other time where Steve, you know, berated some hotel clerk somewhere for no reason and just completely verbally abused them, and that's part of his eccentricity, versus like, no, he's just being a fucking scumbag, and people don't like that.
But I also think that there's something beyond just the social media. Like, if you're looking for examples of white guy assholes that think that their shit doesn't stink, I think that we have some pretty prominent ones right now that are in the backdrop of a lot of people's desire to use social media for a different kind of organizing. And that's also what you're seeing from these investors, or you're seeing from people at JFK, you're seeing from cab drivers, or just protesters. Like, there's something beyond, there's something that's happening in this moment that is going beyond what has happened before, because it's just not new for Uber.
Let's hope so. That's what's up. We got to get to what's next.
All right, now we're going to get to what's next as we try to cut through the laughter at an actual really good research story with a really hilarious title. So Nielsen Entertainment recently released a report talking about basically the mainstream appeal of black content. And we were all kind of cracking up a little bit because the full title is "For Us, By Us?" Question mark. The mainstream appeal of black content. And
what
and
a clever title.
What a clever word phraseology.
The way they did that.
The Negroes will love that. A homage.
Wow.
Homage. For us, by us.
I actually like the image that the Nielsen editor is literally like a 1950s like Coke model glasses wearing, like, gotta get Kennedy in the White House, see, and have an homage to the Negro.
For us, by us.
For us, by us.
But all jokes aside, this is actually a really interesting report now that we've kind of set it up that it's funny, but it's not funny. And coming off an amazing win by Moonlight, I'm all in my feelings about black content. So this is perfect. And basically, just to summarize, and then we can open it up, because we're not going to go through too much about the actual report, though we do encourage everybody to check it out. And we'll have links in the show notes, is that their summation is that content that is largely either made up of black cast or have what would be considered black themes actually do well among a wide swath of viewers, not just African-American viewers. And they highlight certain shows, Black-ish being one of them, where the percentage of African-American viewers of Black-ish is 20%, leaving 80% to be non-African-American viewers. A show like How to Get Away with Murder, one of the many Shonda Rhimes shows, 30% of viewers are African-American, 70% of them are not, and the list goes on and on. So clearly when the idea that a show might be too black, too urban, doesn't reach wide enough an audience. All these usual things that are being used in entertainment, whether that is film
can't
or
really
TV.
Get into Empire though.
Yeah, can't really.
That's a little black.
Little black.
I'm looking at the numbers on that one. Don't know black. About Empire,
but very popular.
Very popular. Though actually, I can't get past the second season.
Me neither.
Too much melodrama for me.
Me too.
I think a lot of people dropped off after that second season or in the middle of that second season.
But I built the empire. Shut the fuck up.
But I mean, I think it's a bigger conversation about what gets attention, what doesn't. When these shows are showing that they have legs, they're successful, and they're reaching an audience that isn't just quote-unquote urban/black.
There's a quote in the article at the top. It says, in fact, 73% of non-Hispanic whites and 67% of Hispanics believe, get ready for the belief, that African Americans influence mainstream culture.
Get out.
So this for me is also just a moment of like,
well,
thinking.
How do you consider, what do you consider mainstream, like, young lady?
At what point was that not true?
Right.
You know, and what we're really talking about here is like, in some ways, to your point about the Oscars, we're talking about space for those stories to be told in a new way. Because, you know, Elvis was heavily influenced by black content. You know what I mean? Like, at what point are we looking back and American media of any sort did not have this influence? And so when I hear those numbers, 20%, 80%, like, we're talking about, in rough cuts, America embracing black narrative as an important and central part of our collective narrative without it needing to be watered down by white voices.
And I also, I mean, look, that's obviously undoubtedly the case that, you know, African-American culture, black culture is like, you know, is a core engine of American culture. So that's always the case. I would be interested when we go down these numbers to also look at, like, you know, Blackish, to me, that's fascinating because that, to me, like, shows once again that, like, that's the sitcom family, and it's approachable, it's relatable. There's an interesting kind of class dimension to that show as well. And, you know, it makes sense in that. That, to me, like, can almost, like, fit more almost in, like, the Cosby slot as, like, what we're doing is, like, solid, mainstream, approachable entertainment, and theoretically there's a humanization in that. And then you look at shows like Atlanta and Insecure, which are, you know, Atlanta is much more evenly divided. That's almost like 50-50, in fact. And then Insecure actually goes 61-34% African Americans over non-African American viewers. But both of those shows skew much younger.
They're,
you could
so
also
good.
Think they're both, you could think of those shows as really like millennial shows in certain ways.
Yeah.
They're playing with narratives, and particularly Atlanta is playing with narrative in a way that I just haven't seen on television. I mean, that's just a really distinct and special show. So I think what you're seeing here is, it's like, you know, from Blackish kind of demonstrating again that, like, okay, there's a mass market for a good sitcom, period. Even if it is told in the, you know, through non-traditionally represented voices. And then I think when you get this cluster of shows like Insecure in Atlanta, it's interesting to me because the broadening of viewership and race representation is also connected to me with like a gender broadening, a generational broadening, an issues broadening, and definitely in Atlanta, major class and inequality broadening.
Yeah, it just reminds me all the time of when movies or shows that don't have the traditional sort of cast or themes do well, everyone's amazed. You know, like when Hidden Figures is like the number one movie at the box office, or very recently Jordan Peele's new movie, Get Out. Like $30 million. Like everyone is like, oh my God, how did this happen? And we're constantly like telling this story. And I'm like,
don't impersonate me,
dumbass,
from what I say off air.
People
on
are
here.
Going to these films. They're going to these shows. They're watching this stuff. And what I would like to see is almost the reverse of this model, because people also think, like, for example, that like people of color or women don't go see other movies.
Right.
Like, this happens all the time in sort of the Marvel universe, like, let's just say, like, the superhero nerd world, where, like, Marvel famously didn't have, like, a Black Widow action figure, even though, like, that's a principal person in the Avengers. Like, there's all these stories where, like, women, people of color, and are excluded from the mainstream when they're big supporters of the mainstream. And it makes absolutely no sense.
There's a little bit more of that perspective in Insecure in Atlanta, that, like, those sort of hard distinction, like, just even having characters like, you know, like, yeah, Issa consumes broad pop culture, just as, like, a simple example of that.
I also am looking at the list and just having personal reflection about where I first saw some of this stuff. And, like, the first time I saw Blackish was on a plane, you know, like, where is it getting placed? And Issa came out of the internet. Like, she's a YouTube success story.
I watched
her YouTube show
like 5 years ago.
Yep. Yeah.
She
did speak at Influencer Conference in 2012. Whoop, whoop. Shameless
Always
plug.
On it. Dope boys. Subscribe. Tell your people.
But also, you know, Shonda Rhimes has a cult following. Twitter has been nothing but, path of glory for everything she's touched with a pen. So I just think it's interesting to think about, where's this stuff even finding its audience is also the question. Like, who's there? How are they finding these people? And how are they building from that? Because we've all seen great shows that only lasted one season. And a lot of these great shows have gone on and on and on. What's allowed that to happen?
And we got to figure out a way to incorporate voices. I mean, this is something you hear us constantly talk about, this idea of understanding culture, understanding the power of diversity. And not everything should be relegated to a dollars and cents equation, but it's about inclusion. And studies like this show that people will gravitate toward good stories. And whatever your business is, whether you're in the direct idea of storytelling, i.e. you're making a film, you're making a TV show, or you're tangentially related to storytelling, you're a creative working in advertising and in branding, the more you can understand that your messaging needs to appeal to, you know, the kind of some of the core ideas of humanity. And you get away from this idea of strictly testing everything toward demographics. Again, we talk about post-demographic reality, a constant theme on the show. And I think, like, studies like this Nielsen study support that. If you had tested many of these shows against what you thought the audience would be, you would have failed miserably in all of your planning, not just the actual making of the show, but even the way you would sell the show to potential advertisers.
That's right. And, you know? And the different way. I mean, just even the fact that, you know, there's 91% penetration rate for, you know, smartphones in the African-American community. I mean, that helps. Like, that is the other element of, you know, I think on the far afield, just as an example, a great sitcom that, well, the latest iteration was terrible, but the original was very, very funny and just couldn't survive because it didn't hit its numbers, Arrested Development. In today's environment, there would be a whole social media cult around that show, which would have made canceling it a very different proposition. And then the other distinction, you know, obviously, like, and then made the joke about Empire, but that also shows that's plus 60 African-American viewership, still a major hit, got Emmy nominations.
So and even it's a queer show.
Sorry?
It's a queer show.
And it is also a queer show as well, exactly. So that's a good point, right? So that also shows that even with which I think overlaps what you're saying, Phil, too, that, like, this kind of, and then Blackish is, you know, the kind of universal and specific. And then I think what you see with Insecure and Atlanta are also representations of these new opportunities and outlets with proliferation of even FX to some degree, because the number demands they have are different. And certainly Netflix and definitely HBO, you know, you're talking about finding different audiences. And it can be, you know, a million people who are, but at the same time, like, you know, not many people are going to watch Insecure. overall relative to the whole population, but it is this, you know, it's a show that'll be talked about, it'll be blogged, it has prestige, it influences the medium,
it covers all your bases,
it covers all your bases, so that's another thing that you need to consider with all of this.
It's also exciting because it is centering Black producers, Black creators, Black writers. Like, this list is not just Black actors or just Black plot. This is Black production. And, you know, coming out of recently watching I'm Not Your Negro and looking at the way, you know, Black commodification was a path for a certain sort of placement in the marketplace, this is a different conversation. This is not selling things to people in the same way as it is production. It's not just consumption.
Yeah, I'm Not Your Negro. Wow, that is a fucking great movie.
Yeah, run.
Yes, go see that. And that's what's next.
Next.
Digging in Crates is where we bring you a piece of work that you'll find interesting. It's going to make you smarter, nimble, faster, better. I got two for this week. One of them is on a sad note because Bill Paxton, who's one of my favorite actors, passed away just this past Sunday. And I randomly like odd actors that like I really put on a pedestal. And he's one of my guys. Like years ago when I was editorial director for a magazine called Free Magazine, I did a story about going back and looking at Oscars in hindsight and people who should have won. And I felt that Bill Paxton should have won an Oscar for Aliens because he was just the standout guy in that movie to me. And so in honor of Bill Paxton, I'm going to recommend watching Big Love, which was a show that it premiered when HBO was still very much, I think, in Sopranos mode and The Wire. And it had these very seminal shows that have gone down in TV history as being like masterpieces, Deadwood, which is actually my favorite. And having said all that, I still think like Big Love is an amazing show. It has great performances all across the board. It was very much a departure for what we've seen Bill Paxton in up until that time. And it might not rise to the level in terms of branding that the other great HBO shows of its era were in, but it's still an amazing show and better than most of the other sort of so-called prestige dramas. So shout out for Big Love and Bill Paxton. And my second crates, which actually came up as a result of our talking about Uber, is one of my favorite websites, Naked Capitalism, did a multi-series posting about Uber and can Uber deliver. And it's very deep policy wonk financial breakdown of why Uber, regardless of everything that we talked about, which is still very important from a cultural perspective, why as from a financial perspective, Uber is a tremendous failure. So I would recommend that series, and it's right now at 7 blog postings, Can Uber Deliver? And it's part of Naked Capitalism, nakedcapitalism.com.
My crate dig for the week is Flashdance. It is the best feeling. If you have never seen it, I recommend it for sure. The whole movie is great. It's so like stylized, and you could cut up a million scenes from it and just in the YouTube fashion of having just bite-sized things to consume. It offers multiple music video type scenes, an awesome set that puts a strip club in a steel factory or whatever the right terminology would be together to create a beautiful platform for one of the best strong lady movies ever, one of the best loft apartments ever. Jennifer Beals in Flashdance, definitely one of my top 80s picks and one that I recommend to everyone in this time when we need more joy and more dancing.
I do not have a joy-based movie recommendation. But it is, sorry.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. It's not as bad as The Act of Killing.
Okay.
That movie is so good.
It's so good.
Yeah, but you went deep
with
that one.
I did. Everybody were like, this is a great new album, and it's kind of electro pop, and it's really fun. I was just like, I think fundamentally, the human experiment is probably doomed to fail. And in that light, I'd like to recommend The Brief History of The Act of Killing. Yeah. But which actually, again, if you haven't seen it, you really should see that movie. But I want to recommend a movie that is pretty recent. It was kind of a sleeper movie in 2016. It got some Academy nominations, but it wasn't one of the kind of like dominant ones. And it was Hell or High Water with Jeff Bridges, Chris Pine, Ben Foster. It's actually not literally, but according to screenwriter Taylor Sheridan, it's the kind of thematic sequel to Sicario, which I also liked. And he has a third film coming out, which is going to be about a rape investigation on a Native American reservation. And he's writing this sort of like trilogy of like the modern, like Western frontier space, basically. And this movie is really pulpy. It's really like, it's an homage to the 70s. It's about two brothers robbing a string of banks for a very specific reason. But there's actually also a lot of, in a very well done way, it is also about banks, and it is also about ruining the modern economy. And it also, in its own way, just because of its setting, speaking of like representation in films, like there is a presence of Mexican, Native American, just because that's the space it's dealing in. And it's a really good movie, and Jeff Bridges is the best. So that's my pick, Hell or High Water. Brother, Phil.
Another ride.
Biz, thank Busy B. Thank you. Super producer Matt Leck. Creative director Shauna Wan. You know where to find us, at Two Dope Boys Pod on Instagram, at Two Dope Boys Pod on Twitter. Get in touch with us. See you on Thursday for On Point.